Hi, Marco here. January will be here before we know it, and that means time is running short to make your gift before our fundraiser ends on December 31st. A sincere thank you to everyone who has already donated to our nonprofit newsroom this year. It truly means a lot. Your gift helps ensure that we are able to continue this crucial work. And if you haven't donated yet, now is the time. We need you. Your donation goes far beyond dollars and cents. It validates the importance of our work and enables us to tell the stories that matter to listeners like you. You're not only helping our newsroom flourish, you're also paying it forward for your fellow listeners who are not in a position to donate right now. Please make your gift today to sustain our nonprofit newsroom. You can head to theworld.org/give to donate and learn more. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you so much. Israel expands its offensive in Gaza as it continues to pursue Hamas fighters. The death toll keeps climbing inside Gaza, and one community in particular is being pushed to the brink of extinction.
My fear is that we are experiencing the last chapter in the history of that community.
With fewer than 1,000, it is a real concern. I'm Marco Werman. Also today on the show, Education 2.0 has arrived in Korea.
Korea is an example that has introduced AI-based digital tutors for students.
It's unclear, though, if that alone is what it'll take to improve academic achievement, which globally has been slumping. And we learn the art of yoiking.
In the tradition, it's actually quite concrete because you can, like, yoik, for example, an animal or a wolf.
It's all about careful breath control. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us today. As Israel battles Hamas and pounds Gaza with artillery, international mediators are working furiously to hammer out a ceasefire between the two sides. That appears unlikely in the short term. Today, Palestinians fled from the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis as the Israeli army moved in. The Hamas-run health ministry says some 21,000 people have now been killed, millions of people in Gaza displaced, and for weeks have been facing shortages of water and food. The war in Gaza has impacted everyone living there. The World's Shirin Jafari brings us this report about one small and often overlooked community in the territory, which fears for its very existence.
Every year around Christmas time, Khalil Sayegh and his family in Gaza used to decorate a tree. On Christmas Eve, they would all gather at the house and have a big family dinner.
We would listen to music, we'll drink wine, and it would be really fun. And then on the 25th, which is the day of Christmas, we go visit family.
Sayegh's grandparents left what is now Israel during the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. His grandfather was a jeweler, and once he resettled in Gaza, he opened up a store, which he then passed on to his two sons. Before the current war, there were about 1,000 Christians in Gaza. That's out of about 2.3 million people. The numbers have dwindled over the years as Christians left Gaza in search of a better life. Sayegh remembers growing up as a Christian in Gaza.
I lived under the occupation. I suffered from the siege. I suffered from the Israeli inhumane policies toward Gaza.
But that's not the only reason he left Gaza for Ramallah and then immigrated to the U.S., he says.
I did have to deal with situations where Hamas's members would want to try to intervene in your personal life.
Like, he says, when he went out with his female friends, he would get questions about whether they are married, the only way it would be permissible for them to be together, according to Hamas's rules. But Sayegh says nothing prepared him for what he's been witnessing in the past 2 months. Early on in the war, his family were forced to leave their home, which was destroyed in the bombardment. They took shelter in one of Gaza's two churches.
The Christian thought that perhaps the church can provide the protection, that perhaps the sanctuary of the church, the holiness of the church, the special status that it has, will protect us.
Their calculation turned out to be wrong. Last week, the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem said that Israeli snipers shot and killed a mother and daughter at the Holy Family Parish. The Israeli forces say they were responding to rockets being fired by Hamas militants. When Khalil Sayegh heard the news, he got even more anxious. Reaching Gaza is almost impossible, he says, so he kept in touch with his cousin in the West Bank. On December 21st, she called him.
And she asked me if I heard from my parents, and I said I did not, but I think they're okay.
They weren't, his cousin said. She'd heard that his father had passed away.
It took me a few hours to one day to confirm the news, and also one day to know what the circumstances were.
Sayak found out that his father had some sort of illness for the past few days. He's not sure exactly what, but there was no way to get him to a hospital. A doctor who's sheltering at the church told him he thinks he died of a heart attack. Sayak and I spoke the day after he had received the news.
He was truly a person of peace. Always talked about peace, always talked about the need to reach a peaceful solution.
Reverend Mitri Raheb is a Palestinian Christian and the founder of Dar al-Kalama University in Bethlehem. The way he sees it, Israel is making Gaza unlivable for everyone, but he particularly worries about the survival of the tiny Christian community in the enclave.
My fear is that we are experiencing the last chapter in the history of that community.
So far, there are reports of 21 Christians killed in Gaza. That's 2% of the total population. Raheb describes it as a SOS moment. During his annual Christmas address, Pope Francis talked about the war. He said it is destroying the lives of people in Israel and Palestine. He pleaded for an end to the military operations and the release of the Israeli hostages held by Hamas.
La parrocchia di Gaza.
Khalil Sayegh, who lost his father at the church, says he continues to worry about the safety and well-being of the rest of his family in Gaza. But as he mourns, he says, there is one thing that gives him some comfort.
Thankfully, they were able to bury my father.
So many people in Gaza today don't get the luxury of a dignified burial, he says. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
We've been reporting on all sides of this current conflict between Israel and Hamas since October 7th. All our coverage can be found online, along with a comprehensive timeline of historical events leading up to the current fighting. That's all at theworld.org. Across the globe, there is an alarming trend, a noticeable decline in academic performance. That's according to a recently published survey by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD based in Paris. An analyst with the OECD called the trend unprecedented. To find out why, we turn to Andreas Schlecher. He's Director for Education and Skills at the OECD and is in Paris. Start by telling us a bit about this survey by your organization.
Since the year 2000, we have been tracking student learning outcomes by conducting tests around the world. The latest test was done in 81 countries, covering basically all of the industrialized world and some of the developing countries. It is covering all continents, and the target group is 15-year-olds, so basically students towards the end of their compulsory schooling. It's the largest and most comprehensive test of student knowledge and skills, focusing on reading, mathematics, and science, but also looking at some other kind of cross-cutting.
So what surprised you most about the 2022 results in the survey?
Well, first of all, we've seen a marked decline in academic standards, particularly in mathematics, which was the focus of this year's assessment. There has been very little progress over the last 20 years, one must say that, but now we see a clearly marked decline across the countries, and not everywhere. There are some countries that have bucked that trend.
The decline in performance has been described as unprecedented. Which countries in particular do you see this decline the clearest?
Well, the United States is one example. The decline by 13 score points, that's more than half of the school year in just 4 years. But we have seen in big European countries, you look to France, Germany, similar results. The region, the world region that has withstood that kind of overall decline is Asia. You can see Singapore moving from good to great. You have Japan continuing delivering top-level outcomes, Korea. So you can exempt East Asia from that, but in most other world regions, you see this pattern.
Yeah, so let's get into the why. What is causing this?
Clearly, the pandemic has been one of the factors. We see very clearly where schools have had longer school closures during the pandemic. Results have declined more markedly. But there have been other disruptions by the pandemic. So that's one factor. What we've also seen is that technology use for leisure is markedly negatively related to performance on a PISA assessment. And that has increased in a number of countries to fairly high levels. We have seen a decline in parental support. That's true for the US, but also for many other countries, parents being less engaged in the education of their children. And then in some countries, not for the US, but in many other parts of the world, students no longer reporting that teachers know who they are, who they want to become. You take all of this together, and that's probably a fair amount of the decline explained by that.
Yeah, that's many reasons. As far as COVID, are there countries that were less affected by the pandemic than others? And when you think about places like that, can you understand why?
Some countries have handled the pandemic quite well. They minimized school closures, sort of schools were pretty much in operation. The students got really good level of digital support, very good support from teachers. All of that has helped those countries work through that difficult period quite well. In contrast, you go to South America, schools have been closed sometimes 2 years with very little in alternative offer and very little digital alternatives. And so those countries have been quite severely hit by the pandemic. The US also has been among the countries where school closures have been longer than on average, and that is one of the factors that made things difficult.
It sounds like you're saying you actually see a correlation between smart COVID policies and an increase in academic performance. Is that right?
Absolutely. You know, smart COVID policies, meaning also that countries have taken interesting and important lessons from the disruptions caused by the pandemic, for example, intelligent use of technology. Korea is an example that has introduced AI-based digital tutors for students. So students no longer just have to raise their hand in the class. They can turn to their devices, which follow them, which, you know, understand where they advance, where they make progress, and then give them even personalized homework. And all of that has accelerated through the experience of the pandemic.
Interesting. The report also makes a point that the world is no longer strictly divided between rich and well-educated nations and poor and badly educated ones. Talk a bit about that. Is that because less well-off nations are just investing more wisely in education and vice versa in wealthier countries?
Yeah, this is actually an interesting development. You know, in the past, you could always neatly divide the world in between rich and well-educated nations and poor and badly educated ones. Whereas nowadays, take a country like Vietnam. You know, that is still a developing economy, but one of the world's leading education systems. And that is sort of a new development. And conversely, you can take quite wealthy education countries delivering just so-so results, including the United States. So this is clearly a new development where countries that are poor but making very deliberate investments in high-quality education build a different future.
The OECD asked about happiness. What countries did you find students were happiest? And in terms of academic performance, were those happiest of students making the grade?
Yeah, actually, I mean, Japan is an interesting example. Japan did always well academically, but in the past used to struggle on happiness and social and emotional outcomes, whereas now we can actually see a very strong sense of student belonging.
When I think about the falling academic performance in a place like Finland, which for years had been the gold standard in the world of public education, I wonder what needs to change in those places to reverse that. And how seriously is Finland, or the U.S., for example, how seriously are they taking the need to fix things?
Yeah, Finland is a disturbing case. It was the gold standard for many years, and it's seen a consistent decline over recent years, in part because, you know, society became more diverse. The system was not very well equipped to deal with this, in part because some educational ideas and reforms were put in place too hastily and not quite well implemented. I think these are important lessons to take. Your school system today is going to be your economy tomorrow, so those countries should take those results very seriously. I would say the same about the United States. 50 years ago, the United States arguably had the world's leading education system, and that could build a world-class economy that fuels the kind of workforce that you have today. Whereas if you look at academic standards today, they are just about the average. And in a high-wage kind of economy, that is not a good starting point.
We've been speaking with Andreas Schleicher. He's Director for Education and Skills at the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, speaking with us from Paris about the results of an international education survey. Andreas, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. December 26th, or Boxing Day in the UK, is pretty much like our Black Friday. It's synonymous with family, food, shopping, and football. I'm referring, of course, to soccer here. This year on Boxing Day, the UK's Premier League made a bit of soccer history in a match between Sheffield United and Luton Town.
Samuel Alisson taking charge of the game today. He becomes only the second black official to referee in the Premier League and the first since Uriah Rennie back in 2008.
Yes, only the second black referee in the league's history. When it comes to players, the Premier League is incredibly diverse, with representation from the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. As for the referees, that apparently is still overwhelmingly white. To discuss this, we're joined by Morgan Afori. He's a journalist with the Guardian newspaper and joins us from Birmingham. Morgan, how big of a surprise for you was it to see Samuel Alisson officiating this match yesterday? And what did it mean?
I think it was an amazing moment. I think, as you say, 15 years since Uriah Rennie stepped out onto the pitch. He himself had a very storied Premier League refereeing career. It was obviously a big surprise. It took so long for someone of a similar ilk to take the job. Obviously, Sam Alisson, from my point of view, looked like he did a great job. But obviously, there are lots of reasons why it's taken a while for this to be the case.
Within the whole National League system in lower leagues, is the diversity issue any better, any different?
I'll say the grassroots has a lot of diversity. The diversity is actually quite apparent. However, if we're talking about making it sort of into the elite levels, there has been some parts of the game that have been resistant to change. And some of those, you know, charged with promoting referees through the scales falling short of standards.
Has the Premier League recognized this as an issue, and how are they handling it?
It's very important to understand that in terms of the referees that work within the top two divisions, that is primarily the PGMOL. That's their responsibility.
PGMOL is the governing body for referees in the UK.
Yes. So it's about initiatives at each level that sort of facilitate progression. What the PGMOL have done is that they fast track some of the more talented ones that have kind of been hitting a glass ceiling. A few of them are of colour, a few of them are diverse in other ways. Like you had Rebecca Welsh taking a match a few days ago. She was the first female referee of a men's game, and it has been a glass ceiling. That's not something that's a secret. It's been widely reported. For example, former Premier League referee David Ellery, who's one of the most experienced referees in world football, had stepped down from his role due to comments he had made in 2014. He told a staff member they looked rather tanned and that if they'd been down a coal mine. But there were other sort of accusations of people that were sort of right at the top that had not been sort of forthcoming in allowing for the game to really change. My discussions with people close to PGMOL, and they understand that in the past there's not been enough focus on ensuring that there is this more sort of diversity, and that's why they announced the Elite Referee Development Plan. It was a bid to increase standards but create a broader pool of diverse officials at the top level of football.
Since yesterday, Morgan, have you spoken with the younger generation of Black and Asian kids and how they view this over there?
From my conversations with people in the past, in terms of grassroots referees, they felt that it was one of those things where if they go in there, they're refereeing in a part of England where there's not many sort of people of colour. You know, observers might not have taken to them because they don't know how to kind of speak or deal with people that are of like different backgrounds. I've spoken to some referees that are grassroots that don't necessarily feel like they've been racially discriminated against, but class has played a part. Some of them pinpoint socioeconomic reasons as perhaps the largest factor for accounting for the lack of sort of officials that progress through the levels.
How optimistic are you that we will now see more diversity overall in officiating in the Premier League?
I think I'm very optimistic. I think there has been big movement to remove the barriers that were previously in a lot of talented officials' path, you know, in their way. I think it's important that the game has learned a lesson as to how to kind of filter through officials that are ready and are ready to take the game by storm. And yeah, I think the face of elite refereeing is 100% changing, and there are plans to ensure that diversity is being addressed in a sustainable way. And so hopefully we'll see more referees of talent from a range of different backgrounds.
Journalist Morgan Ofori is with the Guardian newspaper and has also been recognized with the Unheard Voices Football Writer Award by the Kick It Out campaign, which works to rid soccer of racism in the UK. He joined us from Birmingham. Morgan, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Up in northern Finland, close to the Arctic Circle, lives musician Anna Madat. As she tells us, that's where she performs what's known as yoiking, an ancient music tradition of the Sami people.
I come from a Sami reindeer herding family, and actually we have a multicultural family because my father belongs to this reindeer herding big family and my mother comes from a Finnish family. So I have been growing up in this, like in the border to the both cultures. Of course, that gives a little bit like an ethno-stress that I have been like feeling since my childhood. But doing music and doing yoik, it has really like healing me somehow. I have really now got this tight connection to my roots in my father's side in the Sami family. The yoiking tradition, that's like a chant that we describe something with the yoik, or we remember someone with the yoik. So we are not like yoiking off somebody, but we are yoiking that person as a whole thing. In the tradition, it's actually quite concrete because you can like yoik, for example, an animal or a wolf or a place, like for a special mountain, a sacred place. So that's, I think that's quite concrete, and you also have to have a really close relationship to the objective of the luhti, because otherwise you can't describe it. When I make my music, then I like yoik the reindeer herding tradition that my ancestors created and made it possible to live in the Arctic area, because reindeer is something that gives us life. We're so connected to the land through the reindeers. This yoiking tradition is like a little bit like disappearing, I would say. So, and also we don't have that much space for it in the ordinary life. But the most important thing for me was I felt really connected to the style, and I really wanted to start to learn it and make my own interpretation of it.
That's musician Anna Madat bringing her own sound to the ancient Sami tradition of yoiking. This music is from her latest album, Dreamscapes. Before the Taliban took over Afghanistan 2 years ago, there was a group of Afghan soldiers you likely never heard about.
These girls are 100 pounds sopping wet, and they're running in full combat load, kicking down doors and doing very hard, scary things.
We meet the Afghan women who fought beside Americans. And that's coming up this half hour on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's been more than 2 years since the U.S. pulled out of Afghanistan, leaving behind a humanitarian and social crisis, as we heard in reports like this from NBC.
People are desperate, some selling their kidneys for cash.
The situation is very bad. We are in a fast unraveling humanitarian crisis, and the level of suffering is quite unparalleled.
Meanwhile, Afghans in the U.S. who fled the Taliban have been living in relative safety. The story you are about to hear is one that could only recently be told. That's because the woman at the center of it would have put herself and her family in danger if she revealed who she is. We're going to call her by her first name only, Seema. Seema was part of an elite unit of fighters called the Female Tactical Platoon that secretly fought beside U.S. Special Forces on dangerous combat missions. Journalist Andrea Smardon has been following Seema's story in her podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Andrea, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So if these female fighters' identities were a secret, how did you find Seema?
Well, I got help from existing Afghan Americans in the Salt Lake City community who spoke the language and were tracking down new arrivals to help them. These were just regular people who were jumping in to help in an extreme situation, because many Afghans were arriving in this short time frame with very little notice. So I met Seema in a hotel room on the edge of a strip mall. She was housed there temporarily while the refugee agencies were scrambling to find more permanent housing. She was there with a 1.5-year-old son and an 18-year-old nephew. And so all I knew, I heard she was a woman who had served in the Afghan army. I wasn't sure what to expect. But when I met her, I would never guess this about her. She opened the door and she was this small, slight, graceful woman with this loosely draped hijab. And I was surprised that this was what it looks like to a woman in the Afghan army.
Yeah. So what did you find out about her story?
Yeah, so she wanted to be an artist originally as a young person, but based on how she did in school, she ended up pursuing her second choice, which was to join the Afghan army. And so while she was working in the army, she had the opportunity to train to work on an elite unit assisting American Special Forces on combat missions. So here's what she said about that.
When I went to the special military forces, I was very interested and loved my task.
So she said she loved the work in spite of the danger.
Right. And in Afghanistan, I'm guessing that would be pretty dangerous. But what specifically were the dangers?
Right. So what they were doing was going out with the special forces, American special forces, especially on night raids. So that means like dropping out of helicopters in the middle of the night and approaching the Taliban or other targets, maybe in their homes. So here she is telling us about what she did.
Our duty was to search for Taliban women and separate them, investigate them.
So the role of the female tactical platoon or the FTPs is to interface with women where it's not culturally appropriate for men to interact with them. So they separate them from the men. They check them for weapons. I mean, anybody could be hiding a suicide vest, and they ask questions. So this was dangerous work inherently, but they also had to hide what they did for work just from their neighbors and friends. They were defying cultural norms and expectations, a woman in the military in Afghanistan. So if the wrong person found out, they could inform the Taliban. I met a female American service member who trained and worked with people like Seema. These American women were also going out on these dangerous combat missions with U.S. Special Forces, but they told me they were in awe of the bravery and sacrifice of the Afghan women fighters. This woman didn't want to use her name in the podcast because she's still active duty in the military.
While we were there, the majority of the women would have to show up on post or to the military base in their civilian clothes and lie to their neighbors about what exactly it was that they were doing. Just a woman working in the military in Afghanistan itself was progressive, but they had to ultimately be willing to sacrifice everything to do this position. Like, they knew they will always be in danger from not only the Taliban or ISIS, but really from just regular people in Afghanistan that don't agree with women working outside the home, let alone working in an elite unit, working alongside American soldiers. That drive is pretty unexplainable.
Mm. Andrea, did Seema say why she wanted to do this if it was so dangerous and she had to hide what she was doing?
Well, Seema told me she was proud of her service to her country. She felt she was fighting for a better Afghanistan. And her service was inspiring to others. I met an American veteran named Becca Moss who served in Afghanistan. And she said the bravery and determination of Seema and others like her was an inspiration.
I mean, like, these girls are 100 pounds sopping wet and they're running in full combat load, which is 20 to 50 pounds, and carrying guns and, like, you know, kicking down doors and doing very hard, scary things. And like, they want a free Afghanistan and they're willing to fight for it, which is pretty amazing. I don't think any of us can even understand that. Like, I don't think I can understand that because I've never had to fight for freedom in my life, like, ever.
Incredible. You said Seema was there with her young son, Andrea. What happened to his father?
Right. Seema met her husband, who was also working in the military, assisting the U.S. And shortly after they got married, she found out she was pregnant. So she stopped going on combat missions, but her husband continued. And as I was asking her about the dangers of her work, she started getting emotional.
When we went to carry out operations during our duty, we saw many young people being killed in front of our eyes. And we said that they have their own families, wives, and children. What will happen to them? Not knowing that one day I will lose the dearest person in my life.
Her husband was killed by an explosive device while working with Americans, and he never got to meet his son.
So now Seema is a single mother, and then in 2021, Americans are pulling out of Afghanistan. The country's falling to the Taliban. What happened to Seema?
So she was in those huge crowds at the airport that we saw on the news. There were gunshots going off, tear gas. She was trying to protect her young son in her arms. She was able to get a flight out with her nephew and her son, but she was separated from her mom before she got into the airport. And her mom actually was injured in that suicide bombing that happened outside the airport. She's okay, but she's left there in the country. And Seema told me it was really difficult to leave without her mother and also to leave behind the country that she had fought for.
I left Afghanistan a lot and I miss Afghanistan very much. When I left Afghanistan, I was very sad, unlike many who were happy. But I had to leave Afghanistan.
So Seema flew from Kabul to Qatar, then on to the U.S. She spent several weeks at a military camp in Virginia with thousands of other evacuees. She and her son and nephew had been traveling for 2 months by the time a resettlement worker dropped them off in a hotel room in Utah.
And that is where your podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, picks up. Andrea, thanks very much for bringing us this reporting.
Thank you so much.
Of course, Seema's story continues here in the United States, where Andrea Smartin met her with her nephew and baby. Most people have no idea who she is or that she worked with the U.S. military on special operations. And as Andrea reports, Seema's struggles are definitely not over.
It was already dark when Seema, her 18-year-old nephew, and her 16-month-old son arrived at their new temporary home, a hotel on the edge of a strip mall in a suburb of Salt Lake City. They were all alone and hungry, but weren't sure how to find food. Then there was a knock on the door, and a man handed them a warm paper bag. Dinner. Someone was looking out for Seema from afar.
My name's Becca. I know Seema from the military when I was deployed in Afghanistan in 2020.
Becca Moss had been a first lieutenant in the U.S. Army. She was at her home in Georgia, 2,000 miles away, when she called an Indian restaurant in Salt Lake City and placed the order.
I was like, well, I'll just order you a bunch of rice and you can eat it for the next few days, I guess.
The two women served together in Kabul. Ma says that bonded them for life.
I mean, the military is a family. No matter how you spin it, they served right side by side doing the same things.
By the time Moss arrived in 2020, Seema had already been working in the field for several years. Seema was part of the Female Tactical Platoon, a unit of Afghan fighters who worked closely with the Americans on combat missions. Moss was a member of the Cultural Support Team, or CSTs, an army unit of American women who assisted U.S. Special Forces. Moss and Seema worked together training Afghan recruits. Then, in July 2021,
we're ending America's longest war.
President Biden announced his plan to follow through on the agreement made under the Trump administration to completely withdraw U.S. troops by the end of August.
Is a Taliban takeover of Afghanistan now inevitable?
No, it is not.
But as we know now, by mid-August, the Taliban did take over. Moss had finished her tour of duty by then and was back in the U.S. She said her first thoughts were of the Afghan women she served with.
I was like, probably a lot of explicit words, but I was like, how the heck can this be happening? How can I help? Can I help?
She started texting her fellow CSTs and they pulled every string they could think of, working their network from high-ranking military officials to soldiers on the ground at the airport. They succeeded in evacuating 43 members of the female tactical platoon and 100 of their family members. Helping their fellow soldiers escape Afghanistan was not part of their official work for the military, so Moss and other CSTs formed a volunteer organization. They called it Sisters of Service. Their mission, to help their fellow soldiers rebuild their lives in America. Each member of the Afghan female tactical platoon was paired up with an American counterpart, a sister. Moss says Seema was the first to be resettled in the U.S.
I was like, oh, crap. Like, you know, of course it's Seema, the girl that has a two-year-old and this nephew, and she's in Salt Lake City. And I was like, who the heck? No one knows that she's in Salt Lake City.
Moss called Seema's caseworker at the resettlement agency.
You know, let them know who I am and be like, you know, I'm her friend. I'm just trying to make sure she's okay. I'm not going to leave you alone, so you might as well just accept that I'm going to be in your life.
By the spring of 2022, Seema had moved out of the hotel and into an apartment. She had also found a job working part-time as a cashier at Walmart. Through a translator, she said it was quite different from the work she was doing in the military.
She said, yeah, it's completely different for me. In Afghanistan, I was working as a special operation, and here I'm working as a cashier. I just want to do this job because I need to improve my language, to find a military job in here.
You want a military job?
Yes.
But Seema said she was worried about how she would pay her bills once she stopped receiving money for rent and childcare from the U.S. government. Resettlement agencies across the country received only about a year of funding for each Afghan arrival. After that year was up, the new arrivals were expected to support themselves.
She said, I need to work because everything is really expensive, the rent, the food and everything. And I have a child. I need to buy a lot of stuff for him.
Seema said she was also worried about her legal status in the U.S., Like most of the Afghans who were evacuated in a rush in 2021, she arrived on humanitarian parole, a temporary status that allows her to legally live in the U.S. for a limited time. She still had to apply for asylum, and it wasn't clear what would happen if her application was denied.
So when I get a lot of stress, and the only thing that can help me, I'm just crying. And it's helped me to feel better.
You're crying a lot?
Seema said she was worried about what would happen to her mother and family still in Afghanistan, who were in danger because of her work with Americans. Becca Moss said it was hard to watch Seema and other former Afghan female fighters struggle to obtain secure legal status in the States and to support themselves.
They don't want to be a charity case. They want to be a strong individual like they were in Afghanistan.
What do you think our obligation or our sort of responsibility is to these women who are now in the U.S. from Afghanistan?
I think we owe them a lot. These women literally are an anomaly. They're from Afghanistan, against all odds, joined the military, joined the special forces, and then like fought for their freedom alongside U.S. soldiers, which is like more than 99% of Americans can say. So I guess, what do you think your obligation is to somebody that sacrificed something for America?
Military veterans who served in Afghanistan continue to advocate for their Afghan allies. Last fall, former Army Captain Matt Zeller stood in front of the federal building in Salt Lake City, along with other veterans.
I'm only standing here talking to you right now because my Afghan interpreter saved my life in a battle 14 years ago when he shot and killed two people who were about to kill me. He was standing next to me because he believed that the American people were honorable people who kept our word.
Zeller was traveling the country with other advocates trying to convince U.S. senators to vote for the Afghan Adjustment Act, a bill designed to speed up the asylum process for people like Seema who are already in the U.S. The bill would also help get more allies out of Afghanistan. For Zeller, the commitment to U.S. allies is personal.
You know, the people I was trying to help get out of the evacuation, I was only able to get out five of the 25 people that I was personally trying to assist to get on flights. 19 of them are still back there in hiding. One of them's dead. We have this ethos in the military, you're supposed to leave it better than you found it. This is the only way I know how to leave it better than I found it.
But to this day, Congress has still not voted on the Afghan Adjustment Act.
In June, President Biden extended humanitarian parole for another 2 years. That extension helped Seema stay in the U.S. legally, which was a relief because she still didn't have asylum. A lawyer volunteered to file her asylum application pro bono. While she waited for news, she tried to move on with her life. About a year after arriving in Utah, Seema was offered an opportunity in Virginia that would relieve some of her stress. A nonprofit would cover her expenses while she took intensive English classes. On moving day, Seema held her son in her arms as she prepared to start over yet again in a new home.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Doing well? How do you feel about the move?
I'm so excited.
I'm so excited? Yeah? It seems like an amazing opportunity.
Yeah.
Seema is studying English, working, and raising her son. And just this month, she received some very good news. She's been granted asylum. 17 of her sisters, fellow Afghan veterans from the female tactical platoon who have also applied for asylum, are still waiting to hear. For The World, I'm Andrea Smartin in Salt Lake City.
You can hear all of the episodes of Stranger Becomes Neighbor, produced by Andrea Smartin, at KSL Podcasts. To hear more of our stories from Afghanistan and from all over the globe, go to theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Take a spin through your local grocery store, and with some imagination and the right guide, the ingredients you take home can transport you to another place. Our next guest can guide your belly all the way to Nigeria. Yowande Komolafe grew up in the country's biggest city, Lagos. She's now a food writer with the New York Times and recently published a cookbook about the food of her hometown. It's called My Everyday Lagos, Nigerian Cooking at Home and in the Diaspora. I spoke with her about it this fall. So your new cookbook is more than a bunch of recipes. It's also kind of a love letter to Lagos and a search to define your own identity through food. What inspired you to write it?
I think that living here in the U.S. and not being able to go home, I go through it in the book where I tell the story of being undocumented and not being able to access the place that I grew up to the extent that I started to wonder if I really grew up in Lagos and if I really had a childhood in Nigeria. And so food is the way I translate the world, and it felt natural to turn to food to help me explain and describe my experiences. And that was the inspiration behind the cookbook.
Yeah, in your late teens, you came to the U.S., you went to culinary school, you worked in restaurants, and you were not able to return to Lagos for 18 years. In that time, what were the challenges you ran into when you first started trying to reproduce the authentic flavors of Nigeria?
I wondered what authenticity was. I had that question come up a lot for me. Like, am I still Nigerian if I haven't been there or if I haven't revisited? Is this stew or these plantains that I'm making in Brooklyn in my kitchen, are they Nigerian because I'm making them or are they Nigerian because the recipe's Nigerian? And I kind of just shifted to the idea and decided that the food that I make is authentic to my experience and that is what it is. I think also a challenge was that I was making a lot of these things from memory and from conversations, talking to my mom, talking to my aunt, remembering how my grandmother cooked. And so I wasn't working off of a script of recipes that I already had. I was kind of creating the recipes from what I remembered.
Yeah. So when you finally were able to return to Lagos for a visit in 2017, how much had the food there changed from your childhood or changed from your memory of what you had eaten?
It was so exciting to find out that the flavors and the tastes that I remembered were so much more intense than I remembered. I was cooking food from Nigeria in Brooklyn, but I felt when I returned to Lagos that what I was making was just, it wasn't intense enough. Like everything in Lagos and in Nigeria just inspired me so much. And it felt like my senses were on fire the entire time I was there. And so when I returned, when I came back from that trip, I just intensified like the pepper in my stews and like the spices in my pepper soup. All my flavors got way more intense and impactful.
Tell us about a few dishes in your cookbook, Yowande, that are really staples of cooking in Lagos.
There's akara, which is it's a fritter made from ground honey beans. It's slightly sweet. If you decide to put some onions in it, like I do, it's got that aromatic flavor. It's something that just reminds me of like celebrations. It's celebration food. It's something that reminds me of my grandmother because she would always make it and wrap it up in newspapers and send it by courier to us. And it requires a gentle touch to make it fluffy and light. I also talk about ogi, which is something that I learned to make during the pandemic, just long hours of sitting home with my 1-year-old. Mm. And ogi is a porridge made from fermented corn starch. And it's a morning food. It's just something that settles your stomach. It's something that I always turn to for comfort. It's almost like eating oatmeal in the morning. It's just warm and comforting, and it feels like a hug in a bowl. And I started buying different colors of corn because it's typically made with white and yellow corn. But I discovered here that I could get like heirloom pink corn or indigo blue corn. And so I started experimenting with different colors of corn. And now I make like a blush pink ogi or like an indigo ogi. And it's just fascinating to see that process.
I love that description, a warm hug in a bowl. But that, you know, the porridgey thing is pretty common all across Nigeria and West Africa, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, we eat a lot of porridges. We eat a lot of starches that have been cooked down until they just like sort of melt away into the broth.
In Nigeria, I mean, Lagos, it's a massive city with commuters spending long hours on the road. How does that day-to-day reality affect who does the cooking and what they cook?
There's a lot of prep that happens ahead of time. And the way I arranged the book by the chapters were kind of as a direct result of that experience of spending time in traffic Monday through Friday in Nigeria. My 2020 trip to Nigeria, I spent a lot of time just like commuting back and forth and spending time in traffic and just going back and forth. And I realized how much time is spent in traffic. And I realized that that does influence the amount of time that you have to cook. And so I noticed that my mom would make a lot of things on the weekends, and a lot of the ingredients she used were like broken down and prepped on the weekends. And so it made the meal times just so much quicker. And so I've sort of adopted that thought process and that prep process, if you will, where I always have ata dindin in my fridge. And that's the base for so many of our Nigerian dishes. And so when I come home after work, when the kids are like running around and wanting to eat, I just know that I can pull out my ata dindin and make some white rice, and then we have a meal. And so there's a lot of prep that happens ahead of time.
And finally, fufu. How can you make that in such a way that it is just like exactly like what you get in Lagos?
Oh, gosh, you're asking for a lot there.
You need the mortar and pestle, and you need somebody
But I mean, now there's like substitutions. And, you know, honestly, most people use the powders in Nigeria also. Not everybody's like buying yams or cassava root and pounding it from scratch.
We should describe fufu before we go any further.
That's true. Fufu is a starch that has been either mashed or pounded into a dough that's elastic. And it's typically used as a vessel for soups and stews. But now they're dehydrated powders made from the starches. So there's like cassava root powder or yam powder. There's gari, which is a fermented and dehydrated cassava granules that are used to make this fufu. And you can make it either by pounding the starch or by boiling the starch and then mashing it. Or you could also just grab a powder and make it into a dough. So there are different ways you could make it. If you're looking for that exact taste that you would have in Lagos, I think that you just have to hop on a plane and go there.
Well, we don't need to do that thanks to your cookbook. Yewande Kumolafe is the author of My Everyday Lagos, Nigerian Cooking at Home and in the Diaspora. Great to meet you, and thank you for the conversation about Nigerian food. This was fun.
So lovely to chat with you. Thank you so much, Marco.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Please join us again tomorrow. Before we go, Marco here with a quick reminder. Time is running out to donate to our fundraiser and help us unlock a $67,000 matching gift. If you've been meaning to donate but haven't yet, we need you to step up now. Your gift will help sustain our newsroom into 2023. Learn more and donate at theworld.org/give.